Welcome to the XYZ Experiment Podcast. I'm here today with Fiona and Luke. Guys, I want to take you back to my childhood. One of the games that we played a lot as kids was Monopoly. On holidays, my sister and I played Monopoly until we used to fight a lot because she used to win quite a bit. But it was one of the key games we played growing up. I am currently reading The Imagination, a Manifesto by Ruha Benjamin, and I found out the history of Monopoly.
You sound like that's not a good thing.
No, it's not a good thing. And so I'm going to read it because I guess one of the things that I really remember is my approach to playing that game was to get wealthy, right? Like you wanted to win. That's how you win.
Yeah.
Is you basically buy the best streets
yeah.
and you build as much property on them. And the whole point of the game is to be wealthy.
Okay.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Listen to this.
Here we go.
Take the game Monopoly, which has sold over 250 million units since Parker Brothers began mass producing it in 1935. Firstly, I didn't know it was that old. Most people don't know that the precursor to Monopoly was the landlord's game. Created by feminist and anti-monopolist Elizabeth Maggie. Maggie, like so many others at the time, was inspired by economist Henry George's 1879 bestseller, Progress and Poverty. She decided to create a game to demonstrate the evils of Monopoly, inviting players to reject the impoverishment and displacement upon which gross concentrations of wealth depend. She applied for a patent in 1903, and three decades later, Parker Brothers would pay her only $500 for the rights. Although Maggie intended players to experience the game as fantasy that eats us alive, monopolizing power and resource ends up, for many of us, being the object of desire, not disdain. So it literally changed the whole thing of the game. So they go on to, Ruha Benjamin goes on to say, those of us trapped inside the capitalist dream are taught to identify with the winner and look down on the loser. But she created it to say, you need to take into consideration who is monopolizing power and the impact that has on everyone around the board.
Wow.
Mm.
$500 back then would have been a bit of money.
Yeah, but look at how much it's worth now. And they've changed it. I think the thing that annoys me is they changed the intent of the game. Mm. It's like one thing to buy someone out for their concept and their idea, you know, what they were trying to do. And I guess it's also in my field of public health, we always try to bring to light inequalities and inequities. And there's lots of like public health kind of games that we'd play with students to help them understand actually what privilege is and intersectionality and all of those types of things. And I feel like that was the intent. That was the intent to kind of say, you know, landlords can monopolize you and send you into a whole thing of poverty. Mm. And we need to be considering that and like mapping it out in a board game and thinking about how people engage with that. And then to have someone buy that game, the rights to that game, and flip it and say, the point of the game is to monopolize, to be the landlord who is wealthy, who is imposing poverty onto the people who are living in that area. So I was just like, oh, no.
Now, yeah, if I was to play it. The way that you see it.
Yeah, well, it changes the way that I see it. And now I feel like, could I play Monopoly now where we say, actually, the winner is the person who buys the streets that are considered not as attractive and develops them to provide housing for for the locals? I don't know.
It wouldn't have solved.
Because I'm interested by this kind of turn for you. Hypothetically, say you were playing the game and I pitched to you this idea of let's flip what we think Monopoly is on its head.
Mm.
Would that have impacted you or changed the way you thought of Monopoly as much as knowing what its original kind of vision, or I guess the original vision for the game was?
So post me playing it, like when I'm playing it and then you said, hey, we're sitting around the table and you said, hey, let's play it differently. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, and I said to you, why don't we try and use this philosophy of it being a little bit, you know, it's less about actually attaining wealth and more about being
distributing
aware
it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And you would you kind of have been like, Yeah, I guess, and kind of rolled your eyes as opposed to knowing now what the actual original intention of the game was.
Well, I think, you know, if I look back on our childhood, my sister was so good at this game that she earned the nickname Solomon Lou.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah.
So Solomon Lou was a property developer in Australia, right? Yes. Yeah, very wealthy, because she would just snap up everything and we would be locked out of the game, basically, and it made it less fun for us. Because she would dominate so much. I don't know how she did it because, you know, she's not actually that competitive. But she somehow worked out how to win Monopoly very well. So I think if you'd told me that, I'd be like, yes, because then I could win. But also, I think I've always had that concept of, like, what about... I felt sorry for the poor streets. Mm. I always felt sorry for them on the board. I mean, this whole concept of how do you imagine an alternate reality is the point of this book, really. Mm. And I think our concept of what it is to be a winner is set by systems and hierarchies and, you know, all of those and power and all of those kind of things. It does take a big stretch to kind of think, how do you imagine a different world for everyone? Where the winner isn't the person who is the wealthy person. Mm. And you're really trying to, you know, basically say, let's have a game which makes you think. It's not about you winning. It's really helping you think about this is the evil that comes from being in a consumeristic, you know, kind of world. Where it's all about just gathering more stuff for yourself.
Because I feel like we're living in that world right now.
Yeah, but it was set up back then.
I know, but we're living in that world, that dystopian world as we speak.
Yeah.
Like we're actually living in that world where there's a real divide and power control of the super wealthy
yeah.
at the moment.
I don't know. Like it's really, and we've seen it even in Australia, like the streets that became gentrified. Right, the suburbs that used to be the poor suburbs, and now are the really wealthy suburbs, like Collingwood and Fitzroy and Richmond used to be where all the poor people lived in the worker cottages, and you know they set up like all of these different organisations to help them because that's where they all gathered, and now no one can afford to buy there. Because it's been gentrified, and you think, where did everyone go? Anyway, I'm not 100% sure I'm going to keep playing Monopoly. But has
do you
that,
still play?
Well,
I haven't played Monopoly in years.
I haven't played it in years. It is we have a Monopoly in our apartment. Oh no, actually no, I think it's just down in Venus Bay now. But it's more like kids and stuff when people come over that it gets pulled out. But often I'm doing something else. But it has totally changed my way of thinking about how games are developed, and maybe now thinking, what was the backstory to some of those?
Of that story.
Yeah.
If you play Monopoly with kids, do you let the kids win?
No.
See, I do. I help the kids. I'll let the kids win the game.
And that's maybe the bad thing. It's competitive.
Yeah, yeah. Because like if we're playing Monopoly... Because I've played it with my nieces and nephews when we were younger, and I would, like, same as when we're playing Trivial Pursuit, I will openly help the kids win that game, you know? Like, I don't need to win it. I'm happy for them to win.
My nieces and nephews are very good
yes.
at board games, so yes. I don't need to let them win anything. Like, I've had my nieces beat me anyway.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Just straight up.
Yeah.
But do you feel the need to win?
Probably not, and I'm not as probably competitive, so that's probably why this resonated so much with me is because I don't feel the need to win.
Does it resonate now because you're an adult with life experiences and you've developed compassion and empathy and all of that sort of stuff? Would it have resonated as a kid? I'm not so sure.
I don't think it would have as a kid, but even as adults when you were playing it, like understanding this used to be the landlord's game. It used to be about the anti-monopoly.
Yeah.
And now it is about, no, be monopolizing.
I think from my perspective, playing Monopoly for me would be a little bit like a fear response almost. Because I think that philosophically, the way that you described it is more of like an anti-capitalistic game. that is something that I believe in. But I can imagine when you're playing it, and I wonder if maybe that's even why they tried it, like they changed it a little bit, because when you're actually playing it, it's hard not to get swept up in the actual fear of, oh my God, I actually do need to accumulate some sort of wealth, or otherwise I'm not going to have anything. Like, I'm trying to think of this obviously as a game, and as a game, obviously you can be like, I don't care, it's whatever. But in the world that we live in with like the instability and, you know, I can't help but feel as though as I'm getting older, I definitely feel like I'm getting more into some of those traditional mindsets around like accumulating wealth, almost as like a fear response, just because how unstable the world is.
Yeah, I think it is. That's an interesting perspective as well, because you're someone who does play games and video games and, you know, engages in the gaming world. And I totally can see you often play your reality out in those types of forms. But if I think about the games that, I mean, I don't play games as much anymore, but all of the games that I used to engage with on apps and stuff were all community building games. Like, my favorite one was Farmville. Like, there was, you know, you're just growing things, and it's not about monopolizing, but like feeding people and growing your farm, really.
So there was no competition about who could grow the best vegetables and who could do the best. No. So you're not playing games where there's a winner.
I'm playing games to keep people alive.
And did you know, Dash, that actually is probably in the last, I'd say, 10 or so years, that genre of video game is one of the most popular, like, genre at the moment.
So why is that?
The idea, they're called, like, cozy games.
Yeah.
A lot of, like, farm simulating games, definitely. Things like The Sims, creating civilizations, they've always been really, really popular games. But yeah, I think it's for that same reason. Like, there is this concept now with a lot of video games where it's like there doesn't need to be a winner, there doesn't need to be a rush, there doesn't need to be like an accumulation of like victory. It's actually just developing things.
Yeah.
It's actually really, really refreshing.
I only play games where there's a winner.
Yeah, you're bloody competitive. Yeah,
but I just told you, I let the kids win. But I've allowed that. I'm benevolent.
But I feel like if you were playing against us, there would be like, you wouldn't hold back.
I sometimes wonder, because I've never played those sorts of games like farming or Sims or anything like that, I do know some people who do, and fantasy games as well, where they're creating worlds and building worlds. But does that replace your reality sometimes? I know someone who it has. They are more into their fantasy world than their reality world, to the point where they're not working.
Well, I think it's like back to Luke's point is like you could hide in the games because the reality is so uncertain and scary. But I'm watching Four Seasons at the moment.
Oh, yeah, we talked about it this morning. Yeah, yeah.
They talk about one of the couples, one of the wives, all she does is play Farmville.
Yes. It's the first thing that came to my mind when you said that.
But I played Farmville for a really long time, probably until COVID hit, and then I'd stopped. And I'd play it when I was in hospital. I'd play it all the time. And I think for the majority, it's like what, Luke, you were saying. It's a cozy game. It doesn't, for the most part, I think, take people's reality away.
Yeah.
But it's a way to escape reality just for a brief moment to kind of say, if I was building something, what would it look like?
So it's not mind-numbing at all. It's more comforting.
Yeah.
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 Another reality.
Pretty much. But has this happened to you guys where you have found out something about something you used to be very engaged with or something that you really liked, and then you found out a bit of history or a bit of personal information about it and then went, oh, that changes how I think about it?
I'm quite passionate, obviously, about psychology and about reading and writing. But another thing that I'm really passionate about is soccer. And while I was kind of just working in between study, I actually completed, I think it's called a graduate diploma of football tactical analysis.
What? Really?
And so it was offered by Barcelona, the football club. They have a bunch of different training courses around phys ed and different kind of aspects of not only soccer, but also being an athlete. And one thing that was really part of that course that I did over the 6-month period was it was very, very stat heavy. Things like knowing, okay, for example, corner kicks in football, only 3% of the time when a corner kick is taken does it directly lead to a goal. So lots of just like little tidbits about that, about structuring a team, tactics. But as I was kind of getting more and more into it and reading about these tactics and almost like a chess game, how you can do certain plays to lead up to a goal, at the same time, I was thinking there are so many like extraneous variables to this that it almost is just up to chance.
Yeah.
And I started kind of thinking when I was watching games, like I was blanking, like in terms of tactics, I was like, oh, tactics actually matter slightly less here because anything could happen. And so, I think that really wigged me out and impacted the way that I looked at football, because all of a sudden I felt like there was a lot more chaos on the pitch than I initially thought.
That's really interesting, because I always thought that tactics made the team really good. So you're kind of saying even if you have a team full of tactics and all of that kind of stuff, they could, it still depends a lot on luck.
Well, I think so. I think that, like, you know, people would hear that and roll their eyes and say that master tacticians have everything under control. But as I was kind of just reading more and more about it and just kind of continuing to watch football, there are just so many things that you can't control for, that you go in obviously with a strategy, but it just feels like sometimes there's just like sometimes no explanation for why a team might win or lose.
But I've got another view on that. You're talking about the 3% from the corner kick, okay? That's 3% maybe for the best teams in the world. And so the tactic is to try and create that 3%, that every 100 kicks they do, three of them get in. And so that's where the tactician would come in going, okay, I know my chances are 3%, but I want that 3%. You know, I want to make sure it's not 1%, it's not 2%. It's because, as you know, in soccer, you know, sometimes the win is 1-0, you know. So that's, I still think there is something to that, that the tactician would know that, that they would know that we've only got a 3% chance, but let's try and get that 3% chance. Let's try and get that kick in. Whereas if you've got people who don't have that, maybe the chance is zero. You know what I mean?
That's a great point, Fee. I think maybe that was a bad example for me around corner kicks, because you're right, that's a direct leading to goals. But what you'll notice, and if you ever watch a football game, you'll notice like during halftime they have a bunch of stats that come up about what's been going on. And if you kind of continue looking into that, there are so many stats that are taken about different games, like in for all different things. And sometimes you're reading some of those stats and you're like, that's actually you. Like, it maybe it's helpful to know, but in the long run, it actually doesn't really contribute to much. So I just think as I was kind of getting more and more involved in the stats and the strategy, I was realizing there was actually a lot more. It wasn't as structured as I initially thought it was.
It wasn't as controlled and planned.
Yes.
And I think maybe, I mean, both Fiona and I, and it sounds like you also played soccer, sometimes, like, as you said, I remember even, and we were definitely not in an elite soccer team, like, league, but you would just, everything would just go wrong for your team that day. And you couldn't explain it, even though you'd done all of this in training, you'd done all of this kind of stuff, that just nothing would execute. And then another week, everything would execute. So I think there is an element of other factors, and, you know, some of it is just the players on the ground, you know, how tired are they? How hydrated are they? How, you know, is it a wet day, a sunny day? You know, what's the other team doing? But I'm wondering, Luke, do you feel like it's destroyed the game for you?
I wouldn't necessarily say it's destroyed the game for me, but around that time, I was also writing weekly match reports for my local soccer team. So I was doing like 1500 word summaries of like the match and like play by plays. And I think that made me realize there is a lot of overanalysis of sport. Like I would read so many articles with like these play by plays about what was happening and why certain results occurred. And sometimes I was reading them and I was like, that could be the case, but also I'm not necessarily sure it is. And some things you just can't necessarily explain. And around that time as well, and I think a pivotal moment was I was watching one of my teams play. This was an international team in England, and they were playing in an international tournament with a team from a country that's not really known for football. They had like already, it was a two-part game, the first game they'd already won. And in that second game where they should have comfortably won because it was like a home game and it was a team that was in, you know, far outmatched, they ended up losing like 4-3.
Wow.
With like 5 minutes to go. And I remember them asking the coach, and the coach just being like, the coach who's meant to be this master tactician, just saying, it's just one of those games that you just can't explain.
Yeah.
And I think with that in mind, I definitely made me want to step back a little bit from the writing about football, which is why I don't really write articles about football anymore, because I think to enjoy the game, there's definitely a little bit of, you know, speculating and armchair theorizing. But ultimately to enjoy it is just to enjoy the chaos that comes with it as well.
Mm. The gladiator aspect of it too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I mean, they're just our Colosseums nowadays, sports, in reality. That's what the MCG is.
Hopefully no one dies.
No, but it's a Colosseum. So I'm really hoping it hasn't wrecked soccer for you. That it's such a great game. It's the beautiful game.
Yeah, it definitely hasn't. But I think it made me realise that is a, maybe coaching would be a little bit different, but in terms of stats and really deep diving the way I did, it's probably not something I necessarily want to do for my long-term relationship with football.
Yes.
Can I ask a question, Luke? Did you ever watch Ted Lasso?
I did. And I actually really enjoyed that. I only watched the first season, but I enjoyed that there was, again, a level of like airiness to it.
Yeah.
At least the first season. There isn't this real hardcore... and even just the idea of like this person that's not super comfortable with the sport coming and using kind of morale alone to impact a game. I just thought that was really, it was really enjoyable in that sense.
Because that's where I feel like there's a link between my example and your example, is where you strip away everything else and say, who are the humans on the field? And who are the humans on the streets? And how do we plan for the strengths and the thriving of those humans?
Yeah. What about you, Fee?
So now you've got to do an example to match.
Any deep dive?
My example, when we proposed this as an idea, my example immediately went to people that you know, like celebrities, musicians, authors. That's where my head went immediately, about when someone who's done something really terrible and you like to watch their movies or read their books and how it can ruin that experience for you. I have that with a lot of music now. At the moment, I used to really like Kanye West. I don't listen to his music anymore.
Yeah.
But I think to myself, I want to explain something here. You've got these people who are geniuses at what they do. They really are. I mean, let's just say that they are, you know, with musicians and all that. And the world builds them up to be some type of human being. And then you find out that person is deeply, deeply flawed, like every human being is flawed, right? But theirs are so publicly so. And what I don't understand, and I am not condoning any behaviour from these people at all, because it's obviously a lot of times got a criminality element to it and things like that, is they're extraordinary in what they do, but as a society, we expect them to be ordinary in their normal lives. Mm. And they can't be. Because you don't have the extraordinary with the ordinary. So, but unfortunately, some of that extraordinary is very, very dark in their real lives. And so I get it in one way, that person has to have a totally different way of thinking and a totally different way of creating, because that's what makes them so special. So, of course, they're going to have that in their ordinary lives. And it's nice if it's in a good way, but if it's in a really damaging way, then it's disappointing. And so when I find out that it is very damaging and they're tweeting stuff And I think we know more about them because they've got those platforms to tweet and to Instagram and all that and YouTube. So we're seeing it more, because they often don't delineate between their their life, you know, like it's all one. So they still think they're creating art when they're doing those mediums. But it really turns me off them, really turns me off them. So I have a lot of trouble reading their books. I have a lot of trouble, well, I just don't read the books anymore. I have a lot of trouble listening to their music. Yeah, and it's disappointing. And even things, you know, there was the Johnny Depp and Amber Heard trial.
Yeah. Right?
And, you know, people are saying, you know, Amber Heard lost and all that. They both lost.
Yeah.
In my opinion, they both lost in that. And so, like, now I see some of those actors on screen and I just go, yuck, like, you're debauched or you're... Yuck.
Does that mean, like, you feel like you can't watch them in movies, right?
Yeah, I can't take away, now that I know that, I find it really hard to watch them in a role. It comes for me, you know, so I find it very, very hard to watch them do that, or I find it hard to listen to the music, or I think I don't want to give them a dollar of my money.
Yeah,
I don't want to spend that. And then there's other things, like, particularly with authors, and I'm thinking of one in particular who's a fantasy writer who's in all alleged, nothing proven. And I absolutely adore their books and I adore the TV series that are made out of them and things like that. And then I feel anger thinking, well, now people aren't going to do, you know, they're not going to create stuff from that anymore. We're not going to see TV series anymore. We're not going to see movies of those things. And yet the stuff they created was so amazing and I want to see that in the world, but you just can't, you know. And there's so much cancel culture and so much stuff going on at the moment. Sometimes I agree with some of it, sometimes I don't. Like, sometimes I think it goes too far. And if someone's expressed a view and I think, well, actually, I agree with that, but I would never say it publicly. That's what happens for me. Yeah. So I feel sad about that when there's someone that has spoilt it for me. Yeah.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, to share a similar story to you, Fee, there was definitely, I love reading manga, not only because I love the medium, but because I find it a very safe and comforting space. And there was an artist that created a very, very classic piece that I really, really like that is now in prison for, possession of illegal explicit material. And it definitely just... There, like, I know that people say separate the art from the artist, and you can do that to an extent, but there are also times where I just feel like you can't really come back from it.
You can't. If it's so horrible, you can't.
Yeah.
It's just, yeah, because it really is, it does seep into the work. As much as we want to say that it doesn't, I think it really does.
Because you kind of sit there and think, oh, well, I do. I don't know if you guys do as well. They created that art from that darkness.
Yeah, correct. Mm. Yeah.
So it's kind of like, oh, if I'm then enjoying that art, which was created from darkness, what does that mean? Like, I think it does send me into a bit of a tailspin. And I've had that happen with quite a few authors and singers as well.
I do think for some of them there is redemption arcs. I do believe that. And it could have been that it's just something... that might have been very hurtful what they said or did, but it wasn't like illegal or they just need more education around that. And if they get it and they show a true redemption arc around that, then I'm more forgiving of that. I just think, well, there's a person on their personal journey learning and being better as a human being and deeply regretting what they'd said on Twitter 10 years ago. I get that sort of redemption arc. I really do.
But I think, like, in the example you shared and then Luke shared, like, if there's anything with criminality, as you said,
you're done.
Or where there's, like, abuse involved, even if it's alleged or whatever.
The hate speech,
that kind of stuff. I think I get your point on cancel culture, but, like, that's what happens to the everyday person when they do those things is they go to jail. They're cancelled.
Yeah.
Trying to find, was it in White Lotus? I don't know. There was a line someone said, sorry, going back to what you were talking about, that if you're wealthy or rich, the law is just kind of a guide, but you're not necessarily bound by it.
Wow.
Okay. Whereas if you are poor, black, vulnerable, disadvantaged in any way, the law will bound you.
Wow.
There's an interesting point there as well, though, about, and this was something that I think I've referenced this before, the book So You've Been Publicly Shamed.
Yeah.
By John Ronson, I think it is.
I don't know. I haven't read it.
Yes. And basically one thing that he talked about in that book was that the law is kind of based on this idea of things that are not cruel or unjustified. But when a celebrity is subject to things like cancel culture, often the punishment, even though it might be above the law, is often far more cruel and unusual as a punishment than the law could be to begin with.
Mm. But you kind of see people who are wealthy can buy themselves out of being indicted or those types of things. Like, you can see people avoid the legal system or the justice system, whereas if you're an everyday person, you would have to go through that and you probably would be found guilty. And we see that with celebrities, that they can buy themselves out or they can buy part, or very rich
or
people.
Or they can buy time.
They can buy time, and people get let off, or there's, you know, evidence that goes
deals
missing.
Deals are done.
Deals are done.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That kind of stuff. But yeah, I do take your point that cancel culture can be incredibly cruel and can be destroying of someone's future, and there's nothing they can do about that. So that's the law of public opinion, isn't it? Hi everyone, it's Dash. Thanks for taking the time to listen to the XYZ Experiment podcast, and don't forget to leave a rating and a review. If you've enjoyed our show and like what you're hearing, tell all your friends and family and hit that subscribe button. If you want to hear our updates and know when episodes drop, follow us on Instagram at the XYZ Experiment for all the latest updates and news. And our original music was composed and performed by the amazing Luke Champion.